Charles is a square-jawed, black-haired young guy who seems a little short to fight at 185, but he actually has a big cut to get there. He's a very dense dude, a brown belt in jiu-jitsu, and a smooth ground fighter. Jiu-jitsu players don't get belts for free. You have to earn them in a very strict sense and be able to do a lot of things to advance, including compete. A black belt may take 10 years of study. And who you get your belt from matters. Lineage is very important in jiu-jitsu. So teachers are stingy, especially with black belts, because they will be judged by the caliber of their students. A brown belt is a very high level of jiu-jitsu. Charles runs his own school and manages fighters, already at 28 on the back side of things, thinking more about the future. I told him about the new book and what I was here to do. I asked him to describe Liborio's game to me. He chuckled. Rolling with Liborio? You just get flattened. He's so strong, he's unstoppable. It's methodical flattening. You know it's coming, but you can't stop it, because he's more technical and much stronger than you. He laughed again. It's like being pancaked by a steamroller. The pavement thinks it's pretty tough, but as soon as the steamroller comes through, it gets flattened. It's like rolling with your dad when you're 8 years old. He's a total nightmare, and he's not even going full speed. It must be kind of awful to be Liborio, because no one can compete with him. Charles grew wistful. It has to lose a little something. It has to get pretty boring. Ricardo Liborio is a burly, powerful man, with no neck and massive rounded shoulders, the classic build for jiu-jitsu. With a distinguished full head of gray hair, and a cherubic face with bright eyes, Liborio is always smiling. He's gleefully welcoming, almost childlike, and he grabs me with a firm hug. Over the next week, we repeatedly went out to lunch or dinner, and he had no qualms about meeting me every day and chatting for hours, even though the demands on his time were immense. He is sure of his recipe, his method of building an MMA team. "You have to be open-minded," he said, "and understand that everybody is different. But there is a recipe at the same time. You gotta train hard, bring the right people in, and do what it takes to move to the next level. It's about understanding the game. You can get your ass kicked in one fight, and maybe he's better, or maybe it's just his day. He's got the right game on the right day, and he matches up with you. But you can improve your game, take it further, and jump to the next level." He'd smile at me with tired eyes over his food late at night, or over lunch, and answer the phone and talk to his nanny. He was juggling a gym full of egos, running a business, and caring for a sick infant daughter, and he was wearing a little thin around the edges. But his enthusiasm never flagged, not for a moment. Liborio told me stories of when he started jiu-jitsu, back in the early 1980s when he was 15. He was a part of the formative years of the sport, when all the icons of today were young and just finding the gym. Murilo Bustamante was a purple belt. Valid Ismail, Bebel, Zay Mario Sperry, Amori Batetti was just a kid. Liborio was incredulous when he said, "Everybody was so young at the time. I had a gift for it. I liked it, and I got my blue belt in 2 months. As I progressed, I quickly started teaching, too, and I realized that not everything I do is best for my students. The game varies body to body, and you got to understand that." Liborio spoke about Carlson Gracie and his MMA team, probably the most important MMA team of all time. Carlson passed away in 2006, but I had met him in Rio and even gone to cockfights with him. Scotty Nelson, owner of OnTheMat.com and a lifelong jiu-jitsu enthusiast, had allowed me to tag along when he went to private parties with Carlson. Carlson really was the original fighter who adapted jiu-jitsu for MMA. He had his power game, and he said many times, "Never train jiu-jitsu that doesn't work no-gi. Make sure it works both ways," Scotty said. This is something that Marcelo also does, as when he tore through his first Abu Dhabi, he'd been training mostly gi. Scotty, Carlson, and I had been watching a UFC with a whole family of old-time jiu-jitsu players around us, and Carlson was critical of Pedepano's game because he was doing things that were gi-related in the UFC, and getting stuffed, while BJ Penn's game was working beautifully. Carlson felt strongly that training instincts to work only in a sports setting was a mistake. You had to train all the time for the fight, for self-defense. Carlson's legendary team had split up long ago, scattered to the winds, and Liborio was part of that diaspora. Liborio talks about the cultural differences. In Brazil, there's a lot of training, but less instruction. What he means by training is synonymous with rolling or sparring, when the guys just roll hard with each other, looking for a submission. This is a huge part of learning jiu-jitsu, developing those instincts through struggle. Training against real resistance is essential to learning about the intensity and pace of a real fight. This idea, called Rondori in traditional Japanese martial arts, and promulgated by Jigoro Kano, the founder of modern judo, is the beating heart of jiu-jitsu. You need to develop a feel for what a fight is like, the intensity of the moves, how desperation fuels the struggle. For the same reasons it is beneficial, just rolling can be limiting. Sometimes you end up in survival mode, doing the same things over and over, sticking to your few bread-and-butter techniques. This trap can be even worse with the pro fighters, who often think they've had enough instruction and just want to train. Jiu-jitsu players, probably because of the Brazilian to English translation, use train like boxers use the word work. They use it for everything. Liborio makes sure that his pro fighters get instruction as well as training every day. For the good guys, the black belts, it's just as important. They need the resources. We talked at length about Minotauro. Rodrigo Nogueira, the Brazilian top team fighter with whom I'd gone to Japan for the Pride Fighting Championship 4 years ago. Rodrigo had just captured the UFC interim heavyweight belt from Tim Sylvia and was the first fighter ever to have had both the UFC and Pride heavyweight belts. Liborio knew him well, had trained him for fights, and had interesting insight into Rodrigo. He was born with some kind of slow nerves, man, Liborio said with his Cheshire Cat grin. He doesn't get frustrated when he gets beat up. Frustration can take your stamina, your appetite for winning. You get angry at yourself, not the guy beating you. Not Rodrigo. He often gets his ass kicked in the first round, and most people would think, what do I have to do different? But he just waits calmly for his chances. People say he starts slow, but he starts at the same speed he's going to run all through the fight. He keeps going at the same level. And by the end, he's going faster than the other guy, who gets tired. Liborio develops his point emphatically, jabbing at me with a thick finger. You have to understand you can lose. Somebody can beat your ass, but you can overcome. Don't get frustrated. You can't be a quitter. You have to understand loss, that you can lose. It's not your time. It's not your day. Just because you lose doesn't make you a loser. It's not the same fight every time. One day the guy was so powerful, but maybe he's not doing everything right, and he gives you a chance to be better than him. But you can't take it for whatever reason. But next time, be humble enough to understand it's not the same fight every time. Most guys will give you a chance if you don't gas out or emotionally break. He paused and looked around, and thought about how he was going to convince me of the importance of this idea. Everyone is the same for the first 2 minutes. Everyone has a chance to win. But after that, you start to separate physically and technically. He ponders the point methodically. You have to have the fire to develop, to find other ways to win. You can really change your game if you improve in certain ways. You have to keep working hard. Withstand the pression, understand? The pressure. If you can resist it and not get frustrated, you'll step up eventually. One day, you'll just start beating other guys. Some move you could never do. One day, you'll be able to do it. Sean Williams, a Renzo Gracie black belt. You see the lineage qualifier? He's not just a black belt, he's a Renzo Gracie black belt. He trained extensively with the great man, who teaches in Hollywood, California, once told me a story of how when he was a purple belt, he'd broken his jaw. It had forced him to the sidelines for 2 months. As I was recovering, I watched a lot of tape, and when I came back, the other purple belts who'd been giving me problems were suddenly easy for me. It seems to be the consensus. If you keep at it, one day you make a breakthrough. I asked Liboria what he thought of Marcelo's game. The game in jiu-jitsu is someone's style, and it's a reflection of their environment, their teachers, their body type, and their personality. It's as much an artistic expression as an athletic one. Marcelo had recently moved down from New York, and Liborio had been watching him train. Marcelo understands balance well, Liborio said. He can get you off balance very easily. He gets you to shift your weight around. The way he moves his hips, I'm telling you, you can put a 300-pound guy on him, and he'll find a way to move his hips. He's got speed, but it's not oh-wow speed. It's just the way he moves, and he has a lot of knowledge. He researches the position, and there's no wall for him that I can't get there. Liborio is talking about mental barriers, that Marcelo doesn't think of certain positions as static or unwinnable. He has the creativity to look for new ways to get to good positions from the bad. How does that process happen? How do you get to where you can think 3 or 4 moves ahead of everyone? I asked him. I remembered something Chainsaw Charles had said about rolling with Liborio. He knows what you're going to do next before you even know what you're going to do next. Liborio spread his arms wide and smiled. It's just knowledge, man. It's the same for everyone. You go over the basics, and pretty soon, you're dreaming about it like everyone else. Be honest and humble enough to learn from everybody. He thought about it for a while. With jiu-jitsu, you really don't know what he's thinking, but you feel how he's reacting. I can feel when he wants to change the game, and I stop it and change it another way. It's one of the few fighting sports you can do with your eyes closed, because it's about feel. You have to stop and understand, to listen to the position, or you'll miss an opportunity. Guys don't listen to teachers they don't like or don't respect, but you gotta be open if you want to be the best. As soon as you close yourself off, you start to lose. That sentiment would be repeated, almost word for word, by every serious jiu-jitsu practitioner I talk to. Liborio handles all aspects of running American Top Team, and he's constantly revising his theories on the team and leadership. The leader has to be open too, he said. He has to be searching too. He can't say, oh, I know what everything is already. You have to be honest and humble enough to ask how different things go, and learn from everybody, because if you keep your eyes screwed shut, and if you think you know everything, you'll start losing. I believe in hard training, in the recipe. You have to respect your limits. But understand you're an athlete and push on them. You will get your ass kicked. You will get tired. But eventually, you'll be kicking ass. I don't think I was the best fighter, but I can be the best teacher. Because I really care about the guys, all my guys. I care what happens. Just watching Liborio around the gym, you can see that nearly everyone feels they have a special relationship with him, me included. He takes the time to have a few private words with everybody, in particular with every single little kid in there. Liborio spends time down on their level, in their private world. I know from being a student, and the son of educators, that when a teacher is genuinely invested in you, when a teacher actually cares, you can tell, and it makes a big difference. My mother in particular had taught at a variety of institutions, from New England colleges to Indian reservations in New Mexico, and she had come to the conclusion that basically the best thing you can do is love and show unconditional interest. It was the only real way to connect to students. As a student, you can feel it even if you never put a name to it. I've been on different teams. I can remember the struggle to get attention on Carlson Gracie's team. It's impossible for one man, with so many good guys, to pay attention to everyone. So now, I'm just trying to bring in more coaches. You have to put the money back into the team, and the team has to keep growing, or they'll leave. You need someone in charge, though, because that's the big problem with pro fighters, the egos. When they reach a certain level, with the money in the spotlight, they need a leader, and they need to respect the leader and understand the program. The question of ego was one that I had discussed at length with Eddie Bravo, a jiu-jitsu instructor in Hollywood who developed an innovative guard style and was a commentator at the UFC. Eddie is uniquely positioned in the sport. Because of his commentating, He was always rubbing elbows with the best fighters in the business, and watching them, carefully. Ego is a big reason that guys stop advancing in the sport, Eddie said. Because in jiu-jitsu, it feels so bad when you tap. You got killed. Jiu-jitsu is great because it filters out the assholes who can't control their egos, the douchebags who can't handle showing physical inferiority. But for these fighters, once they get famous, they can't just roll. Everyone wants to tap them. The famous guys start limiting their training. It's very hard to take risks to get tapped when you get famous, so they stop progressing. Everybody has ego. I have it too. But you have to be the black belt, and the ego has to be the blue belt. You have to be controlling it. I don't like tapping. I'm teaching my students how to beat me, and they're dying to do it, even though they respect me. But I'll roll with everybody, and I get tapped by my students. I got some vicious dogs in here. But you can't be one of those instructors who thinks it's bad business to show weakness so they stop rolling. I'm selling evolution. You grow or you die. Eddie's been criticized for his style, which he touts as the future of no-gi, as having ways to be beaten. Eddie just laughs about it. Of course, nothing's 100%. Every style has a counter. But it's good to have options. Rubber guard, Eddie's style, doesn't work every time. It's like a punch combination that doesn't work. You don't abandon it. Go back to it. Set it up differently. The only reliable indicator of future success in MMA has always been the quality of training partners. You needed good guys around you to perform at a high level. You need killers in the room, as Gable would have it. The best fighters in MMA nearly always come from the best camps, drawn together to push each other. Liborio was well aware of it. The victory is never yours. It's the team's. It's everybody. The boxing coach, the training partners, the guy who sets up the training schedules and buys the tickets. It helps to have a big gym, with a lot of big-name fighters, because you can get them fights on many cards. I can say to promoters, if you want Jeff Monson, you need this guy on the undercard. On our last day together, Liborio said something that really stuck with me. Maturity is a big part of success in fighting, because it means you understand the game. That losing is part of the game. It doesn't mean to let yourself get conquered, but to know that you can win again. At the right time, you can be great. The key to doing well in competition is to accept. Liborio holds the word reverentially in his mouth, emphasizing with his face and body. Accept you can lose. You cannot perform. Take this big bag of rocks out of your backpack, take the pressure off, and you'll do better. Once you understand that, man, you can do well. At the ATT gym, I rolled with Chainsaw Charles and had the familiar feeling of helplessness. You can feel when the guy you're rolling with is too good for you to threaten, and vice versa. I held my own for a while, but when he wanted to, he took me out of my depth, into places where my knowledge was surfeit. Do I grab that ankle? Do I make space with my shoulder? He tapped me pretty quickly. And then I watch him with Liborio, and Liborio is moving at maybe half speed, and he's dominating and frustrating Charles. I'm used to the feeling, but for good grapplers to run into great ones is particularly frustrating and hard on the ego. Charles has a bread-and-butter move that works on everyone, but when he tries it on Liborio, Liborio takes his back time and again. The deeper knowledge leads to far deeper anticipation. Liborio knows where Charles is going and lets him go there, but he makes it much worse for him when he gets there. Charles's sense of his ability is a little offended, but he just shakes his head and asks Liborio about it at length. Liborio discusses the problems with favorite moves. Often you have a guy, and he does something that's very consistent. He has one great takedown that he always does, and he gets everybody with it, in his gym. In a different environment, a new, bigger gym, where he can't take guys down with it, he breaks mentally. In a fight, it's just like that. Liborio went on to the flip side of the problem. You can be in a fight, and you get a chance for an armbar. Now, the guys you train with are all good black belts, and they never give you the armbar. You never get it. But you can't skip drilling the armbar because you might get it in a fight. It has to be in the arsenal. Marcelo Garcia is the latest incarnation of the iconic martial artist, the smaller, unassuming, nondescript man who comes out of nowhere to defeat his opponents with ease. I watched him roll with a former judo Olympian who's built like a bodybuilder and must weigh more than 200 pounds. The judo guy spent the whole 5 minutes running for his life, standing up and leaping out of reach, backing off, playing like he was going to engage, but never engaging. It's the only way to survive with Marcelo. As with the movie Ali, about the greatest boxer of all time, Muhammad Ali, there's something lacking in writing about Marcelo Garcia. The fictional film with Will Smith playing Ali was good, until the fights start. Then it falls apart. Because the whole point of Ali was the way he fought, the way he moved. That a big man could be so graceful, so fluid, it's entrancing to watch. It's beautiful to watch him fight. I could watch Ali shadow box for an hour. I often thought they should have just cut to real fight footage in the movie, because Ali is a myth and a man doesn't really make any sense unless you watch him move, unless you see him fight. Marcelo is something like that. You have to watch him roll to appreciate him. I'm not saying he's some mysterious Jedi Knight who does magical things, although at times it appears that way. Like all great jiu-jitsu players, Marcelo does the basic things extremely well, nearly unstoppably. He does the basic things to the best guys in the world. He took Renzo Gracie's back for 10 minutes in Abu Dhabi, something you wouldn't have thought possible. I remembered what Mike C had said about Marcelo, the excited look in his eyes when I pressed him about it. He's all he's cracked up to be. I never had a chance. It was embarrassing because a lot of people at the seminar were watching, and they knew I fought in the IFL. Then I watched him do the same thing to everyone else. You couldn't tell who was a white belt and who was a black belt. He made everybody look like a beginner. I asked Mike to analyze Marcelo's game as best he could. Mike thought about it, and then he slowly answered. He's so dedicated. He can think so far ahead, and he never settles into a position. He's always moving on you, forcing you into transitions. People don't realize you have to be in great shape to keep up with him on the mat, and he'll run you out of gas in a minute. People are used to getting into a position and sort of thinking, like closed guard or half guard. But Marcelo is gone, he's attacking, and by the time you get there, it's too late. He's under you sweeping, he's arm dragging, he's X-guard sweeping you. He never stops. I was waiting for my chance to try something. He's a nightmare. You have to keep up his pace to even have a chance. One of the few things I had learned from my no-gi game was that conditioning could make up for a lot. Most of the guys I roll with are much better than me, but sometimes I can just keep moving, squirming and scrambling, and make things difficult for good guys. Especially in a bad position, you have to become a perpetual motion machine. He started out in 03 with arm drags and X-guard sweeps, and he put them on the map. He dominated with those. Now, people start figuring that out. He comes along and he's hitting crazy guillotines from every position. He has a whole series of back attacks. I've been following his DVD series. I've got all 4 sets. Mike is talking about the common practice of famous guys putting together instructional DVDs as a way of making money. It's the old school way to learn MMA, to buy DVDs and study your heroes, to go to seminars. While you're learning what he's been doing, the old stuff, he's pulling out new stuff, stuff people haven't seen. Now he's got so many ways to get to an omoplata, and a guillotine, and a crucifix. They are the big things his latest set focused on. There were 3 or 4 DVDs on the omoplata alone. I didn't realize there were so many variations. He's revolutionized different positions. While you're trying to figure out what he did, he's moved on to 2 and 3 more positions. He had everything mapped out in his head already. Last time I rolled with him, it was all new crazy shit I'd never seen. He tapped me 3 times with the same move, and I can't even figure out what it was. I thought it was a fluke at first. Then I saw some pictures, and he taught it the next day at the seminar. An omoplata with 1 leg to finish. The monoplata. I knew what it was and thought, oh, he's not getting me with this. So I countered, but he shifted to a variation of the triangle armbar, and it was crazy. I had nowhere to go. Now I do it at our gym and blow people's minds. They make me show them what it was, because it's a wild thing. And I'd watched all his DVDs and his matches and never seen it. He's not strong or super fast. He's got solid athleticism in all areas. His mind is better. He causes scrambles, but it's all calculated. His mind moves so fast, he knows what you're going to try and do. He knows your options. He's a solid athlete, but it's not that. He causes scrambles and causes you to think when he already knows what's going on. You're moving so fast without thinking that you walk right into stuff. He caught me with something 3 times, and I should have figured it out. But he makes everything happen so fast, from different angles and different positions. You don't figure it's the same move. You think you're doing good, and then you're tapping. There were times when he had me in stuff, and I was still fighting. I didn't even realize he had me. I didn't know I was in a submission. He was just holding me. It all makes Mike laugh. I wouldn't have thought anybody his size could tap me the way he taps me. The highlight of me rolling with him was I almost got hold of his leg and put his back on the ground. Mike laughed again. I almost got to half guard. He's like a ball. When you try to put him on his back, he never settles for a position. He's always got his legs in, elevating, working under you. I've never seen him in closed guard looking for something. He's always moving, causing scrambles. He's the king of scrambles. Marcelo is also known as not only the nicest guy in the game, but he is jokingly referred to as maybe the nicest guy on earth. So many fighters and jiu-jitsu guys I talked to confided in me that Marcelo was their best friend that it became comical. Everybody is his best friend. From the first time I met him, he lived up to that billing, smiling, gracious, warm, and sincerely interested in what I was trying to do. He's got a round face, wreathed in smiles and narrow eyes. I'm a little in awe of Marcelo, and some of that admittedly comes from my inexperience. I'm a low-level grappler, and when I see what he does to the high-level guys, I find it a little incredible. So here I was, finally sitting down to lunch with Marcelo, and as we started talking, he wanted to make one thing very clear in his thick Brazilian accent. He's not so special. Why do I beat a lot of people? Because I love it so much, that's why. Everything about jiu-jitsu, I love it. The school, the mat, the ring. I always believe that. Maybe I am not better than my opponent, but I know for sure I love my training more. He smiled at me. It was all so simple. The birds chirping, the sun shining down around us in suburban Florida, Marcelo beaming at me. Thanks a lot, Marcelo, I thought. That's a big help in trying to understand your thought process. It was funny how hard it was to get these guys to talk about how they think. While many will admit that the great jiu-jitsu players do think about jiu-jitsu differently, they get resistant when you try to quantify that. I'd asked Scotty Nelson about it. Scotty had been a white belt with BJ Penn back at Ralph Gracie's gym. Do some guys think about jiu-jitsu differently than you and me? Absolutely, he replied. All the top guys think about it differently. I was hanging out with Nino Schembri. He was the guy back in the day submitting everybody. I asked Nino, how did you get good at submissions from all these different positions? He said he looked at all the bad positions, all the spots where he wasn't strong, and tried to figure out a submission from there. He doesn't fight to get into the right position. He learns and practices submissions from positions he's uncomfortable in. Nino said, I'll never be the best wrestler. I don't want to be. But I figured out all the takedowns and have a way to flow into a submission. Off a double leg, I look for the triangle. Off the single leg, omoplata. If he goes for a high crotch, I dive over for a crucifix. I take what they give me and make a strong position out of a weak one. Maybe more revealing is the level of dedication that Nino showed, the clinical, thoughtful way of thinking about jiu-jitsu, the depth of his study. It's that level of commitment that is distinct. I found that pattern repeated. Many good jiu-jitsu players will just train, and because they know enough to beat most people, they stop studying and learning. The great ones, though, are fanatical students, analyzing positions and all the tiny adjustments that make a position or a sweep work. The difference between a regular student of jiu-jitsu and the great players is the dedication to studying the game. Sean Williams, who got his black belt in 4 years from Renzo despite being sidelined for months with injuries, would fill notebooks after every training session, writing down everything he could think of. BJ Penn, the so-called prodigy, who some think of as a mysterious genius, is the same way. The stories about him from his early days at Ralph Gracie's academy are all about his fanatical drilling of small positional changes. BJ would laugh about those days and talk about how jiu-jitsu invaded his dreams and daydreams, in the shower, biking home, lying in bed. All the great players talk about it, how it becomes an obsession. I pressed on with Marcelo. We started talking about where he came from, Minas Gerais, a big inland state in Brazil. Marcelo was from a remote town, and, like many in Brazil, he started young in judo. Then he saw his first videotapes of the UFC. "I thought, I want to do this," he said. Marcelo found his first school, and it was an hour and a half by bus away from his home. He was 14 and could make it only 2 or 3 times a week. "You can always train jiu-jitsu if you want to bad enough," he said. Where he lived, there was only a small university and a few options. His father was a retired banker. His mother worked at home. He didn't have the money to go elsewhere to study, but Marcelo realized he could make jiu-jitsu his profession. "I just enjoy it so much. I hope I can make enough to live off it someday, but I decide to make it my life." In his off days, he would just wait and think about the next time he'd get to go train. "I love the energy of matching with each other. I love the way I felt after training, that I'd done my job today. And after a few weeks, I realized I could do this forever. I started with 4 friends, and I was the biggest one. I grew up early, but I was the worst one. The worst one of my friends. I wasn't a natural, but even then, I enjoyed it so much, and I kept making the long journey. After 2 months, one friend dropped out, and I just kept improving. There was one guy who was a man, and he used to beat me up, but then he stopped for 5 months, and when he came back, I could control him. I had proof that I was getting better. I wasn't a good student, and even now, I never say I'm better than anybody. But I know I love jiu-jitsu more than anybody. I love the energy, and that it gets deeper the more you study." Inwardly, I sigh. No silver bullet. "Is it just that you know more?" I asked him. "Sweeps? Holds? Counters?" Marcelo's eyes lit up at counters. He liked that one. "I think I have a lot of counters, understand? I try to make him go into the position I want. I study a lot. I try not to make any mistakes. I try to be perfect, and I have a little more knowledge than most. It's something I think about, how to get him to put his hand there or his leg where I need it. Guys who face me, when they believe they can win, and when they are strong and come hard, that's tougher. When they are tentative or have too many strategies, when they try to beat me in my game." Here he grins and his face lights up. "That's not gonna work, guys. Of course I get caught sometimes, but most of the time I can handle it. I'm always thinking when I'm rolling, and sometimes the guy can't follow my pace and lets me get too far. When it goes too fast, then it's just reaction. You have to train hard for that, train all the time." When Marcelo was 16, his training wasn't hard enough to satisfy him. He felt stifled by the future in his small town, the long commute limiting his training to 3 times a week. At a competition, a teacher named Paolo Cesar invited him to move to a nearby city and train at his school. I asked my mom, and she was shocked, but she let me move if I finished school there. So 2 months later, I moved and started studying there. Marcelo's jiu-jitsu training began in earnest. He loved the gym and the teacher, even though the teacher was just a brown belt. There were a lot of people around to train with, and Marcelo trained 3 or 4 times a day for 3 years straight. When he started with Cesar, he was living on the mats, sleeping in the gym at night, a common enough occurrence in Brazil for the young, poor and dedicated. Eventually, he was given a small room off the gym, which he shared with a roommate. Over the next few years, Marcelo met his wife, got his brown belt, and moved to Sao Paulo, where he started training with Fabio Gurgel, an elite-level coach. He was constantly competing in Brazil. Then came the Abu Dhabi in 03. Marcelo had been a black belt for only 5 months. Marcelo actually lost the final of the qualifiers by 1 point. He'd pulled guard and lost a point, and his opponent ran for 20 minutes. So he wasn't expecting even to compete, and was training in the gi for more gi tourneys. Fabio, the old hand, knew there would be last-minute cancellations and visa problems, so he had Marcelo make weight, and, sure enough, Marcelo got his chance. He had been waiting a long time for it. I was really prepared. I felt nobody could take this from me. I had a hard bracket, but I knew that people didn't know me, didn't expect much from me, and wouldn't have a strategy for me. I could play my best game. Everyone else is a big name. He's a Gracie, whatever. I didn't want to respect anybody too much. I thought to myself, I can win this thing. And then I started to make it real. I started to win, and I got stronger after each match. Marcelo not only won his bracket, he submitted Mike Van Arsdale in the absolute division. Van Arsdale is a former NCAA champion and superstar wrestler who outweighed Marcelo by 2 weight classes. Marcelo swarmed him, slipped up on his back, and choked him out in a minute or two. In the footage of the match, you can see Van Arsdale's utter surprise and disgust that anyone could do that to him. Marcelo embodied what Carlson Gracie had told me and Scotty. All his gi training would work on no gi too. He showed how the X-Guard, a new type of guard that gets under an opponent and destabilizes him, could be adapted very well to no gi. And Marcelo was always aware of what techniques would work on guys no matter the size. He had played a lot of triangle games. The triangle is a kind of choke from the bottom, catching your opponent's head and arm between your legs in his early days, until he realized he couldn't triangle really big guys, but he could arm drag and take the back and choke someone any size. As Eddie Bravo said, "Don't be fooled. Marcelo is deceptively strong. His legs are powerful." Mike C. had agreed, saying, "Marcelo's legs are as big as mine, and he's got bowling balls for calves." More to the point, Eddie talked about Marcelo's squeeze. "Marcelo has an incredible squeeze. He developed a squeeze and took it to levels that no one knew existed. When Marcelo puts the choke on, he has developed his squeeze to a high level, where it instantly constricts and fighters are helpless against it." In 03, when Marcelo rolled against Shaolin, an awesome athletic jiu-jitsu fighter, Shaolin and Marcelo spun into a lightning-quick war, and suddenly Shaolin was unconscious. He hadn't even had time to tap. Marcelo can apply it from odd places, and fighters think they're safe when they're not. When I apply a squeeze in the rear naked choke, it isn't instantaneous. People fight it for a while. I haven't developed my squeeze enough. In the rear naked choke, you apply pressure to the carotid arteries, but finding the right angle and the right kind of pressure is the trick. Practice can make the choke nearly instantaneous, as opposed to painful and slow. Another interesting thing about jiu-jitsu is that it's a game of centimeters. It's made up of tiny adjustments, little things that can mean the difference between success and failure in a move. If I'm sweeping someone, I may be doing everything right, yet missing one small but essential step. My foot is an inch off, or I forget to put a little push, just a pound of pressure, on the knee, and the position won't work. It's about getting all the little things right. One thing Marcelo does do, when he rolls with blue belts or white belts, is try for perfection. The reason I like to train with lower belts is to practice for myself and look for the perfect positions, to get to places with more facility, to really try and make a perfect position. Marcelo cherishes the notion of perfection. I can really improve my holds and practice new things. You can train exactly the position you want to train. There's an Abu Dhabi championship every 2 years, and in 05, Marcelo still felt he had a lot to prove. No one thought he could repeat his success. He had to prove it wasn't a fluke. And he did, winning his division again and placing third in the absolute. Then, in 07, Marcelo said he started to feel the pressure, that he had to win, and he was very focused on winning the absolute. He won his weight division again, one of the toughest brackets in the tournament. He even won through the absolute, where he lost the final to Robert Drysdale, 99 kilograms, by submission. Even though Drysdale outweighed Marcelo by 40 pounds, that win made him a superstar. Marcelo was grinning when he talked about it, though. I improved my game. In my other matches, I submitted everyone, which I had never done before. So I had 8 submissions, including mine, which was good. And then we both started laughing. His amusement was deep and genuine. After that, Marcelo decided to make the switch to MMA. He was having trouble staying motivated in his training, and he had something to prove. It makes me mad. I feel bad. People think I can't do it. I want to prove I can. Marcelo reminds me a little of Rulon Gardner, the Olympic heavyweight wrestler who fought one MMA fight in Pride. Rulon, a huge man, 300 pounds of muscle and quickness, had wondered if he could defend himself, feeling a bit slighted by people who punch. I had an odd experience talking to wrestlers on Tom Brands' University of Iowa team. They would say, "Oh, MMA, that's serious stuff." I would think, everybody here would do fine in MMA. There's a fear of the unknown, an imagined disdain. I know the Brazilians, brimming with machismo, often will say after they lose a grappling match, "You wouldn't beat me in MMA." I'm sure Marcelo has heard that one a few times. Marcelo was adamant. I want to show I can fight equally. I have proved it before, but they still say I can't do it. Incongruously, his favorite fighter is Wanderlei Silva, the axe murderer. Silva was a dominant champion in Japan, an intimidating monster, overwhelming in his ferocity, without showing much of a ground game, although he has a black belt. He was a little like Mike Tyson in his prime. He projected an aura of savage invincibility. He's a polar opposite of Marcelo in terms of intimidation. Silva had a stare down that was psychotic and terrifying on the TV screen. He really looks like an axe murderer. Marcelo said, "I never bother getting angry. I don't need it. I don't confuse angry with intense. I think being angry makes you tired. I perform at a high level without it." Reflecting on what Laborio and Marcelo talked about, I'm struck again by how humble these guys are, how nice, how pleasant to be around. I used to think it was a product of being great, that the truly great fighters learned humility in the process of becoming great. But suddenly, I am struck with a chicken or the egg question. Which came first? Listening at length to Marcelo, Laborio, Eddie Bravo, and Sean Williams talk about jiu-jitsu, I start to think that maybe it's the other way around, that you can't be great without humility. The most humble guys, who are the most open and willing to learn, are the ones who become the best. Maybe you can't be great at jiu-jitsu without it. Don't get me wrong, you need a certain type of arrogance to fight. You have to have the secret in your heart that you will beat his ass, that you are too tough, too technical, too strong for this guy. You have to believe in yourself more than anything. But it needs to be tempered with humility outside the ring or the cage. You have to learn from everyone. If you aren't growing, you're dying. BJ Penn, the prodigy, will sometimes roll with white belts and analyze the awkward new positions they end up in. Not that they're necessarily good ones, but there might be something in it. All of the best grapplers have become eternal students, even the mestre. Perhaps it is this need that makes great fighters humble. They've been forced to learn it from the very start to become great. Marcelo, when he said, "I just love it more," was giving me the secret that there is no secret. His strength was in his joy in the game. Friends in Iowa. It's easy to do anything in victory. It's in defeat that a man reveals himself. Floyd Patterson. My introduction to MMA was a rude one, chronicled in a fighter's heart. I went out to Pat Miletich's gym in Bettendorf, Iowa, to train and fight an amateur MMA fight and write an article for Men's Journal. I ended up getting the snot kicked out of me on dozens of occasions. The choice of gym was an easy one. I chose Miletich because of his reputation. Pat is the prototype for the modern MMA fighter, one of the first champions who could do everything. Most fighters of his day, the early below-the-radar days of MMA in the United States in the mid to late 1990s, were one thing or another. Either they were strikers or they were grapplers. Pat was the first guy who could do it all. He had submissions, great takedowns, he moved like a pro boxer, and he knocked guys out with head kicks. He was balanced, and this led him, eventually, to the top. He was a 5-time UFC champion at 170 pounds, but this was during the dark days of the UFC, when the promotion nearly slipped into oblivion. He had many of his early fights in the days before weight classes. Pat made his bones as a coach. He is on the short list of best MMA trainers in the world. His camp, called Team MFS, Miletich Fighting Systems, was the dominant camp in the sport over the past 10 years, with at times 3 UFC belt holders on the mats. It became a self-fulfilling prophecy. All the best guys were training with Pat, so everybody wanted to come train with Pat. Even in the modern MMA world, with the explosion of huge stacked fight camps, Team MFS is still in the top tier. In the early days of MMA, the fight camps were filled with tough guys and infamous for the beatings and hazings. The Lion's Den, Ken Shamrock's gym, was well known for it, as was Shootbox in Brazil. Guys who wanted to train had to survive vicious beatings and absurd workouts. MFS in Bettendorf was always the real deal, a place where anybody who showed up would get the living shit kicked out of him for weeks and months on end, but it wasn't hazing. That was just life at MFS. A great part of the success of the camp has to be attributed to that intensity, the highly charged atmosphere that Pat created by combining all the insanity of wrestling workouts with the damage and viciousness of hard boxing sparring. I've written a lot about Pat, and we've gotten to be friends, which makes me feel like, A, I've said it all before, and B, I don't see him so clearly. Pat's a good guy and a good friend. He's funny, friendly, maybe a little burned out after so many years and so many champions, but he's still scheming. He's a fighter, and a freakishly tough human being. I'm plagued by a recurring rib injury, but when I cry off a sparring session, Pat never believes me. He thinks I'm being a big baby, and he suspects malingering. In his whole career, street fights included, he's never been put down from a punch to the head. I remember Freddie Roach saying that great fighters are special people, by way of an excuse for any silliness, any diva behavior or eccentricities. Freddie was talking about James Toney. But it's true with a lot of great fighters. You can hem and haw, say this and that, but they're just stronger, denser, tougher, and faster. People talk about Rodrigo Nogueira's otherworldly grip strength, or how Fedor Emelianenko's bones seem to be much heavier and thicker than normal, or how Randy Couture's lactic acid levels drop when he's exerting himself during a choke. Pat's like that. He's special. As John Wertheim documented so well in Blood in the Cage, there really is a cult of Pat in the gym. He's charismatic, funny, and maybe a little crazy. When I arrived at MFS in 04, another young fighter had made the move out from Chicago to give professional MMA a shot, a 21-year-old kid named Rory Markham. Rory was powerful, with all-American G.I. Joe looks and an explosive boxing style. He had the same sense of humor as I did, and we got to be friends. Rory's clean-cut looks were marred only by his hands, which were stubby and white with scars. He'd been a very serious street fighter in high school on the south side of Chicago. He told me he dutifully went out and got in a fight every Friday and Saturday night for about 2 years straight. He'd been obsessed with fighting from an early age, and he had his share of demons hidden under a layer of gregarious ease. Over the years, we kept in touch, and sometimes I went to see his fights. He was a big 170-pounder, having to cut from 195 or more, and the first few cuts were tough on him. Rory started as a striker, pure and simple, a banger who nearly always had to eat a few to give a few, but Rory had a good chin that he trusted. He loved to fight, to get in there and mix it up. Still, the more we talked, the further his career went, the more he started to think about the rest of the game. He took a loss here and there, which gave him pause. When he looked at the top of the division, the monsters up there, he knew his physical gifts and striking weren't enough, because those guys could do everything. Rory was a talented, tough fighter, but right on the edge in terms of natural gifts. He was fast, strong, and tough enough to blow through most guys in the bottom or middle tier. But he was well aware, from sparring at Pat's over the years, that he wasn't going to be able to do that with the best guys in the world. He had trouble with head movement. He would do it religiously during shadow boxing, but almost never during a fight, nearly always getting tagged a few times. Still, even though he knew better, his evolution as a fighter continued mostly in one direction, striking. It was what he loved. The New England winter afternoon was already growing dark as I boarded the bus to Mohegan Sun. It was the now-defunct International Fight League's, IFL, Grand Prix, the end-of-the-year event. I was there for a few reasons. It was close by. I was wintering in Massachusetts. Pat was there, and Rory was fighting on the undercard. I got on the bus with Pat, Rory, his assistant coach Steve Rusk, and L.C. Davis, his fighter at featherweight, who would be competing later for the title. The bus rolled away into the darkness, and I was struck by how much MMA history was on board. Along with Pat, Zemario Sperry, Randy Couture, Carlos Newton, Frank Shamrock, Matt Lindland, Boss Rutten and Renzo Gracie would show up later. All giants of MMA. All disowned or persona non grata with the UFC, which was having a competing event that night, to which we stood a distant second. Pat, in particular, was feeling the sting as Matt Hughes, his former protege, was fighting for his career in the main event at the UFC. Both Matt and Robbie Lawler had left Pat for lucrative offers to start up their own gym, and Robbie had been like a son to Pat. Rory claimed to be feeling good. He was ready and anxious to get this over with. He was fighting second, which was early for him. His opponent, Brett Cooper, was an unknown. Nobody knew anything about him. That happened frequently in MMA, though less so at this level, but it always made me uneasy. Rory had made weight. He'd done an hour and a half workout the day before, the morning of weigh-ins, which sounded funny. Wasn't that a little long? I thought the whole point was to sauna and sweat it out, that last 7 pounds of water, without exercising and burning into your reserves. But these guys were professionals, and I was sure they knew what they were doing. Mohegan Sun is a good venue, with steep walls that packed the crowd in around the ring, and it was a full house. Brett Cooper looked small. He'd weigh in at 168, whereas Rory made 170, but put at least 10 pounds on overnight. Yet he was determined. He had his game face on and long, shaggy hair. Pat wanted Rory to jump all over him, to start fast. When the bell rang, Rory went right to him, and Brett, being a little longer, caught him right off the bat. That is standard for his fights. Rory always gets hit. He dug down and started banging. Rory has real power, and quickly he had Brett hurt. He even caught him with a head kick. The crowd yelled, and it looked all over. Rory tried to finish, but he fell in on top of his punches. He got too close, fell into a clinch, and Brett managed to take Rory to the ground. Brett was buying himself valuable recovery time. Rory slipped on a triangle from the bottom, a basic choke, catching the opponent and choking him in a triangle between your legs and one of his arms. He nearly had it. They fought in that triangle for what felt like 10 minutes. It looked like it was over, the triangle was on so tight. But Brett didn't tap. Finally, Rory gave it up. He thought about a transition to an armbar, but he didn't believe in it himself. It was half-assed, and Brett pulled out easily. The fight went back and forth briefly before the round ended. Rory, in the corner, was bleeding from several small cuts. But then, he always is. In the second round, Brett was still pretty game, and he caught Rory a couple of shots, a grazing knee, and then Rory covered up and ate an uppercut and went down, stunned. Brett leaped in to finish. That was it. The ref waved it off. Rory was TKO'd. Contrary to popular belief, The first thing, the very first thing a fighter sometimes feels upon losing, is relief. It's over. The stress, the hatred, the desperate battle for survival. It's finished. When you're knocked down with a good shot, you don't feel pain, Floyd Patterson, the gentleman of boxing, once told The Guardian journalist Frank Keating. Floyd had been the heavyweight champion after Rocky Marciano retired. He'd beat Archie Moore for the interim title in 1956 and was almost too nice a guy for it. Maybe it's like taking dope. It's like floating. You feel you love everybody. Like a hippie, I guess, said Floyd. I remember seeing Anderson Silva lose to Ryo Chonan and seeing the smile of relief on Anderson's face backstage. I've seen that relief gradually giving way to grief as the fighter comes to grips with months of life feeling wasted, of the career and financial implications. The fighter loses more than his pride in the fight. He loses part of his future. He's a step closer to the slum he came from, Patterson also said. Floyd lost a few of his biggest fights under intense national scrutiny, and once he even wore a disguise, a wig and fake beard, in order to get out of the stadium unseen after a loss. The fighter has lost a part of himself, the part that believed in his own power and invincibility. Because what a fight is about, more than anything else, is will. When you're knocked out, I can do whatever I want to your unconscious body. Your ability to make decisions, to master your own fate, is destroyed when you lose a fight. You've been dominated, and to a male of the species, there is nothing worse. It violates every genetic principle in your body. Kelly Whitlock Burden and Hillary R. Rodman wrote an essay entitled, It's Whether You Win, for a book called Your Brain on Cubs, about the psychological underpinnings of baseball and fandom. They discuss experiments with lab rats that showed a male being defeated by another male actually has permanent changes in his brain. Evidently, social defeat is highly effective in producing a state analogous to psychological pain, they wrote. Social defeat sets in motion a number of brain processes that lead to increased sensitivity to subsequent stressful experiences. The hippocampus actually changes after repeated defeat experiences. The hippocampus is well known to be crucial for the formation of memories of specific experiences. In addition, the hippocampus is one of the few structures that make new nerve cells in adulthood. The research shows that repeated social defeats not only can affect the hippocampus's ability to make new cells, it affects serotonin levels and is probably linked to depression. What could be a worse social defeat than losing a fight in front of thousands or millions of people? It's so bad it can permanently change your brain. Those same tests also showed that it was worse if the rats were caged alone. If they had companionship, they sometimes didn't show any effects. Subsequent social support is crucial to the defeated rat and returning to a normal state of mind. The team can save you. I stood behind Rory and had a hand on his shoulder as the outcome was announced. I could feel all the emotions. The animal still wanted to do something, vainly wanted to affect the outcome somehow, to not give up. Rory was shocked, and then disappointed. He'd lost before. He knew what it was. He started grieving, mostly for the lost time and missed meals. He'd been cutting weight hard all through Christmas, and the very first thing he said was, "I'll never fight this near the holidays again." He was grimly embarrassed. Here was a nobody, a guy he was supposed to blow right through, and he almost had. But that nobody had come back to knock him out. I wasn't so dismissive of Brett Cooper. He'd shown a granite chin, and good striking, and excellent submission defense. He'd impressed me. Rory had clobbered him with a head kick, and he'd shaken it off. The kid was obviously tough. But we should have known that. It wasn't that Rory was arrogant, but he went in unprepared. Brett had the advantage of having seen plenty of tape on Rory, and knowing that it was his first fight against a name guy, and taking it as the biggest fight of his career. Rory tried, but subconsciously, he didn't see Brett as a threat. In pre-fight interviews, Rory had maintained he was training hard, because he thought he deserved a shot at the welterweight title, and that, of the two fighting for it, one might get hurt, drop out, and Rory could step in and fight for the title. That hadn't happened. Neither got hurt. and Rory definitely had been looking past the immediate task. A pet peeve of mine is when fans start griping about a fighter who lost making excuses. Of course he's making excuses. This is his profession. He's going to get back in there.